to Stonewall Spotlight, a new monthly podcast by the Stonewall Democratic Club that will cover the most salient issues in Democratic politics with a big D through the LGBTQIA and feminist lens. I'm Mackenzie Hussman, Chair of Social Media and Website for Stonewall.
And I'm Marcus Levingood, Vice Chair of Social Media and Website. Together, we'll be guiding you through our stories covering the breadth and width of modern politics and activism.
So, Marcus, what do we have on the slate today?
Today, we're featuring an interview with California State Senator Ricardo Lara, Stonewall's endorsed candidate for California Insurance Commissioner.
And honoring Black History Month, our intrepid researcher, Lauren Boisson, is going to give us a little bit of history on Bayard Rustin, widely known as the man behind the dream, one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s lieutenants.
Now, each episode, we're also going to hear the voices of Stonewall's members and leadership, talking about why Stonewall is important to them. And today, we're going to hear from our legislative vice chair, Alana Roche, and Stonewall's recording secretary, Sam Frank.
Fantastic.
I'm excited about this specific piece for everyone. It's because we want you to have an opportunity to hear the voices of actual members of our club.
Yeah. Right?
Not just us, not just, you know, guests of the show, but actual activists that are working every single day towards the resistance.
It's great, great stuff. But first, let's give a brief introduction about the organization. What is Stonewall Democratic Club? Since 1975, Stonewall Democratic Club has been the home of progressive Democrats in Los Angeles who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and straight allies of the LGBT community. We are the first Stonewall Democratic Club in the country established for LGBT individuals and our straight allies committed to achieving equality for all and advancing progressive and feminist values through the Democratic Party. Stonewall is an all-volunteer, grassroots, nonprofit political organization and is among the largest Democratic clubs in California. Stonewall's membership is open to all Democrats, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. We are actively involved in all levels of political process, local, state, and federal.
And the movement really keeps growing.
We are honored to feature the esteemed Senator Ricardo Lara as our first guest. Senator Lara is a longtime member and supporter of Stonewall and has been an honored guest at our events. As an openly gay Latino elected official, he has represented the Los Angeles area in the state legislature since 2010 and has been a strong voice in the legislature on issues ranging from immigration to LGBTQ rights on healthcare.
There were quite a few important bills advancing rights and protections for the LGBTQ community in the last few legislative sessions, and we got to speak to him about it. Senator Lara, thank you so much for coming onto the show. We're so happy to have you.
Hola, it's good to be here.
So let's jump right into immigration. So, hot topic right now. So in the California legislature, you've been one of the foremost advocates for immigrant students. Please tell us briefly about your advocacy at the state level to provide opportunities for education, employment, and the path to legalization for young immigrants.
Well, you know, immigration has been an issue that I've been working on since I was a staffer when I started working with the San Marco Fireball. And the irony was when I got elected to the assembly, it was an issue that I didn't really want to focus on because, you know, people tend to put you in boxes when you get to Sacramento. They're like, oh, he's a gay, progressive, Latino member. I bit the bullet and I dove in and became unapologetic about being a true immigration champion in Sacramento. And it's really what wakes me up in the morning and say, I have the best job in the world to be able to fight for such vulnerable communities, whether it's, you know, our immigrants, LGBTQ community, our working families. And this opportunity that I'm given in such a short span, I need to do the most to be able to ensure that our immigrants are fully integrated into our society, that they feel, especially now more than ever, that they're part of the fabric of our culture like they've always been. And then when you stop and reflect the fact that this country is really made up of not only immigrants, but people who, in somebody in your lineage, somebody in your family, whether it was last night or generations ago, decided to come to this country and to fight for a better life. And so this kind of rebel attitude is ingrained in our DNA as Americans. And this is why I think it makes us such an exceptional country. And despite the fact that, you know, we have a president who is completely anti-immigrant, misogynistic and racist and homophobic, and the list goes on and on and on, one election really does not determine who we are as Americans, as we're proving that here in California and with tremendous victories that we've had across the country in state houses where we've elected, you know, our transgender candidates, where people of color continue to get elected in the South. And so we're seeing these like little victories that are going to, you know, when we couple them together, demonstrates how even in these dark times, we continue to win. And that should serve as inspiration, not only for our immigrant communities, but for our LGBTQ communities to continue to fight, to continue to take that step and run for office, become that campaign manager, get involved in public service at one form or another. And, you know, these are all victories that we can claim as our own, and as we continue to fight the current injustices that are happening in our country.
And you're a prime example for that, not only just for immigration, but for LGBT people, for LGBT people of color. And I think that the community really thanks you for leading a charge in all those various different areas.
Well, I'm very humbled by the support I've gotten, and people thank me. I really see it as an obligation. And, you know, as somebody that has grown up without healthcare, has grown up in a very low-income community with two immigrant parents who were undocumented. And it was something that, you know, my mom instilled in us at a very young age. And, you know, as children, she's like, I didn't come to this country so that my children could be mediocre. You have to do something to give back. And so this is a sense of service, a sense of obligation that I have to give back to the state who has given my family absolutely everything. Identity politics matters. Seeing a gay Latino who's unapologetic about where they come from, who they are, from the east side of town is important. And I'll tell you time and time again, when I speak in classrooms or I go talk to different kids in schools, there's always that 2-3 Latino kids who are outside waiting for me to say that, you know, they're queer and they never thought they could run for office and now they want to be engaged in politics. To me, that's absolutely what it's all about. And I want to encourage more people to take that step and partake in public service, because there's nothing more rewarding, in my opinion, than giving back to the community, giving back to your state and to your country.
You mentioned President Trump earlier is working to rescind DACA, and ICE agents are aggressively pursuing deportation proceedings against law-abiding Californians. What can we do to protect Californians under the threat of deportation?
I have to say that, you know, for some of our younger listeners may not know that we've been here before. In the 90s, what the hatred that you're seeing at the national level existed here in California. Not too long ago, we passed Proposition 187 under Governor Pete Wilson that literally limited and took away resources for our immigrant communities. And that was the first time in my life that I was totally ignorant about the fact that, you know, I was growing up in East LA. I thought we're all the same. I was watching Saved by the Bell. I thought I was super white with my cardigan and my polos, living my best life. And then all of a sudden, this is on TV and we're singled out. And at that point in time, you realize, what are you going to do? Are you going to allow this to happen, or are you going to actually demonstrate that our community isn't like that? And that was a direct attack on like my parents. And seeing them such hard workers and seeing them very vulnerable and scared really frightened me, because that was the first time I actually saw my parents genuinely scared for their safety. And then came, you know, Prop 209, the anti-affirmative action proposition. Then came 227, which was the English-only laws, which I'm so blessed that last year I was able to repeal that with Proposition 58. And really, it was the birth of my political career, of being unapologetic of who I was and also fighting for my parents. So now we're here again, and we're here at a federal level, at a national level, where this discourse continues. But I can tell you, you know, I wish that the state legislatures actually would have more of the immigration policy under our jurisdiction. But what California has done under the leadership of so many folks that have come before me is provide the resources and the protections at the state level so that people can access financial aid, people can access loans. One thing we did last year, which is phenomenal under my bill, was for the first time ever, we become the first state to allow immigrants to take out professional licenses so that, and these are 40 different professional licenses that you can take out from the state, from a beautician to an architect. And if you pass the exam, you can work as an independent contractor or open up your own business fully legally and work as a professional. That is not happening anywhere, but it's happening here in California. And lastly, on this issue, I would say what we don't want is people to live in fear. We want people to be careful. We want people to, you know, be proactive when it comes to not only protecting themselves and their families, but not allowing people to live in fear, not making sure people are still going to school or accessing healthcare. It's so vital. Nothing's more important than your health. You know, we've seen already people withholding care for themselves, especially we've heard a woman almost died in LA County because she wanted to have her baby at her home because she was scared that she was undocumented, she was going to be deported from the hospital. Nothing is more important than your life. Nothing. And being able to access services that we fought in the legislature to provide to immigrant communities is exactly why we're doing this. So, you know, I would just tell our community and those of us that have friends and family who are undocumented, be careful. Let's, you know, not live in fear, but protect yourself, understand your rights, and also don't let fear, you know, rule the day. And the irony is that these are so many parallels to our LGBTQ community, right? And the other interesting thing is a lot of the leaders of the Dreamer movement are actually queer, undocumented students and student leaders. And that's done precisely because our attorneys were saying that as queer Latino immigrants, they can actually apply for asylum. And that is one legal strategy and why you see so many queer people joining this fight.
Our next topic is a very, very hot topic right now, Senator. I'm sure you know all about it. Marijuana, the big 420, right? It's coming close. I mean, April, no, not really. But California is now in the recreational marijuana business.
Yes, we are.
What happened in Colorado suggests that we can expect a significant increases in traffic accidents, unfortunately, as people drive while they're baked. This may prompt increases in auto insurance premiums, which premiums are already too high. How do you propose to insulate consumers from increasingly punishing transportation expenses?
Right. Well, you know, we got to look at this issue holistically. And the fact is that driving while high is and will continue to be against the law. And we really need to get to the point is, and this is the crux of the issue. It's really difficult to legislate human behavior. Mm-hmm. We can pass bills till we're blue in the face or, you know, and try to modify people's behaviors, and we just can't. And so what the data actually really suggests is what's more dangerous than even DUIs or driving while high is distracted driving. And we've seen that the numbers have gone significantly up, even though we've passed some of the strictest laws to, you know, prohibit texting while driving.
Right, under phone, people on the phone, all that stuff.
So this now falls into that category as well, right? Mm-hmm. Distracted driving continues to be the biggest problem when it comes to our accidents in our very urban areas. And so we have to do a much better job of educating folks, obviously. And as this law continues to evolve, is how do we identify resources to continue to help educate folks about just distracted driving? People are literally eating, reading the paper, reading their phones while they're driving. And that is a major problem. And we also see the irony of when the economy is doing well, people are working, people and gas prices are low, people drive more. And that just naturally increases, accidents.
Right, of course. And more people on the road.
You know, right. Which is
going to be baking while they're driving.
Exactly. So hence why we need to do a much better job, and we've done, and we're working to ensure that we have much more robust public transportation systems, that we actually get trains and buses to where actually people live, and ensuring that we provide other options for folks that maybe choose not to drive or choose to, you know, drink or choose to smoke and not get in the car. The part is like, how do we provide people additional options so that they don't get in that vehicle?
Right, they can just stay off the road.
And your question to the rates is important because what we've done in California with Prop 103, which really included now major regulatory reforms under the Department of Insurance for home and auto insurance rates, that the insurance commissioner actually is the one that has the final say on approving the rate increases. So you need a robust insurance market because you want to make sure people get their payouts if and when they get an accident, but you also want to make sure that it's affordable for folks. Mm-hmm. And And this is why a couple years ago, we worked to modernize the low-cost auto insurance plan that we have in the state to allow folks, especially low-income folks, to be able to access this, you know, low-income option for auto insurance rates. And what we've also done is allowed now our immigrant communities to actually partake in the program. What we need to do is do a much better job of advocating for the program. One of the ideas that we've brought up is, why shouldn't you have a brochure about the low-cost auto insurance program when you get your driver's license in the mail? To give people an opportunity to see. Right, right.
It should be.
Right. I'm just thinking, how do we allow people to understand that there's a you can get minimum coverage, it's affordable, and that the state's going to help you with, you know, cover that. And what we've seen, the folks that actually use the low cost auto insurance program is that they use it to build on further from, and as the year goes by, they actually build up their coverage, right? So it's a good way to start. It's not a scary product that's from some insurance company, it's actually from the state.
Right. This goes into the next question, which is great. And oversight is incredibly important when we're talking about price collusion. Does California have enough oversight of insurance companies right now to prevent price collusion? And like, are you satisfied that California has adequate provisions in place to encourage robust market competition?
You know, it's again, really fascinating. And I love this question because now we're trying to make insurance sexy for people, right? But insurance is very vital for our existence. You know, I always say everybody hates insurance until you have to use it and until you need it, right? And so the collusion question really gets to the fact that there has been federal laws passed, I think in the 40s, that allowed for certain information sharing between insurance companies and without triggering any antitrust laws. But what we've done in California has actually gone much further. And again, through Prop 103, is again, the insurance commissioner actually has to approve the rates, and then we have to see if the rates are appropriate for not only the product, for the amount of coverage that they're providing, and the amount of liability that that we're actually getting as well. And so we've been able to go further than the federal government. The irony is now under this new Congress, they've been trying to eliminate the protections that we have, the antitrust laws for the insurance companies, and they haven't been successful, thank God. But what we've done in California, which by the way is the largest insurance market in the country and sixth in the world, is again add these additional protections that allow the insurance commissioner to have the final say when it comes to the rates and if the rates are appropriate or not. And this is why I think you need somebody who can provide that perfect balance, right? You don't want to disrupt the insurance market, but you also want to make sure it's healthy enough so that people are getting the payouts when they need them. Now, as you know, we try to work on Prop 45 in 2014 to be able to put in healthcare insurance companies within the Department of Insurance, and it failed. We need to revisit that because we're seeing the huge skyrocketing cost of prescription drugs. And we see that in, even in some cases, for example, we're seeing across the country that when an individual is, you know, gets their PrEP medication, that already considers them at a high risk and therefore have to pay higher for insurance rates under their healthcare plan, which is ridiculous. Because what you're actually doing is you're actually being very responsible and you should actually not be penalized for that. You actually should get a savings in
and
your insurance
plan. And it could be discriminatory, too, if you look at it, right?
Completely.
I mean, and talking about drug prices, right? We've watched the cost of life-saving drugs skyrocket inexplicably. I mean, we talk about insulin. We just talked about PrEP. I consider it a life-saving drug. Absolutely. Like crazy. How would you leverage your post of insurance commissioner? You talked a little bit about it, but more so to push back against Big Pharma's appetite for these outrageously huge profits that are just plaguing us right now.
You know, I think we've taken some very important steps, and it's taken us a couple years in the Senate with the passage of SB 17 by Senator Ed Hernandez, which really now forces pharmaceutical companies to justify the cost for their medications. And I think that's a good first step. Again, we need to get to a point where we amend our constitution to bring in healthcare insurance companies into the regulatory scheme of the Department of Insurance, which currently does not exist. So what you're seeing is a free-for-all from our pharmaceutical companies. I just was visiting Canada, looking at their universal healthcare system there, and had specific questions about their drug pricing policies. And very interesting. They actually, the provinces get together, meet with the pharmaceuticals, and actually they, as the provinces tell them how much they're going to pay if they want their drug in the in their market. Can you imagine if we were to be able to do that under a single payer system with the purchasing power of 40 million Californians, the largest market, and saying, no, pharma, this is what we're going to pay you for this specific drug. And we're going to base it on a formulary that we're going to look and use at what you're charging other countries.
Exactly. And look at our power, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you're not going to say no to us.
As opposed to, and right, I don't see pharma leaving the California market. Right,
the biggest market.
But what we can do is make it more fair for the average family. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're seeing that the individual family is pitted against a big pharmaceutical company, and they have to fight to be able to get their medication. Not only is it not fair, it's inhumane, and it should not be happening in the richest country in the world and in the most powerful state in the country. The biggest irony, when I was talking to the health minister in Quebec province, and I asked him, give me an example, how much would you charge for PrEP? You know, how much would you charge for, how much would you, you know, bill that? And they're like, we can't tell you because through our, you know, formulary, we can't disclose that. But I can tell you that in the U.S., you are paying five times the amount. Mm. And the irony is that those drugs are being manufactured and created in California. Mm-hmm. And yet we're bearing the brunt of the price for the rest of the country and the world for that. Mm-hmm. So we need to get to a point where we regulate, just like we regulate home and auto insurance, we need to bring in healthcare insurance into the fold so that we not only use the purchasing power of 40 million Californians, but that we provide it in a proper regulatory scheme to allow us to not only cut prices, but also understand the efficacy of these new drugs that are coming into the market.
And a lot of people, Senator, don't understand the significance of your expertise on this on this issue. And the reason why I want to bring this up, because I have followed your track record and your leadership when it comes to single-payer healthcare, specifically with the introduction of SB 562. You've led the charge when everybody else is talking about how difficult it is. You say, well, you know what? I've got something on the table, right? And you understand that healthcare is a right. It's not a privilege. When you introduced it, which if everybody at home, it would have established universal health coverage for Californians. I'm sure you didn't understand, you know, what the backlash and, you know, what would happen to it. But now that you are running for commissioner, insurance commissioner, how would you continue your advocacy for healthcare for everybody as the healthcare commissioner?
Thank you. Thank you. You know, this has been a lifelong fight for me. As I mentioned earlier, you know, I grew up without any sort of care. And for us, going to the hospital was driving 2.5 hours to Tijuana to get care because, one, we didn't have insurance. Two, we couldn't afford it. And three, my parents didn't speak the language. So, and these are all barriers that continue to exist today for many Californians. And, you know, I thought, to talk about ignorance is bliss, I thought everybody did that. I'm like, what do you mean? You're going on vacation? No, my vacation was, I'm going to go get a root canal in Tijuana, right? Like, we're going on a family vacation. Or we're going to go buy my mom's high blood pressure medication down south, right? And so we always mixed our vacations with healthcare. So we never got to really enjoy, you know, just hanging out on the beach. No, because you're going to get your physical, you're going to get your, you know, teeth cleaned or whatever. So so for me, this is something that's always been a life passion. And this is why I was so proud 2 years ago to get our Health for All Kids bill done, which ensures that every child in California has access to comprehensive and full scope Medi-Cal. And to tell you that now over 200,000 children in California have signed up for the program. And these are kids that had no other type of care. They ended up in our emergency room, which only costs three times the amount for the state. Why not provide somebody with full-school Medi-Cal so that they can have a doctor, have preventative care, children can actually go to school healthy and not having to worry about what's wrong with them. And, you know, again, looking at a child's experience holistically and making sure that not only they go to good schools, they have good healthcare, they have, you know, a good, healthy life where they live with clean air, clean water. And all that is connected, right? So then we moved to ensuring my next bill was to include our immigrant community into the Affordable Care Act. They discriminated against undocumented immigrants from being part of the ACA, which makes completely no sense.
No sense at all.
You want more people engaged in the program and check this out, 30% of our undocumented community can actually pay into the Affordable Care Act. And we know now, even with this, you know, so-called tax reform that the Congress just passed, it's going to elevate rates. This is why now we need to include more people into the system to make sure we democratize those rates. And by allowing more people in the program, it stabilizes the program. It was in that discussion where we passed my bill with 2/3 of the vote, with bipartisan support in the House and in the Senate, and the Governor Brown signed it. I was in Washington, D.C. advocating for it. We were moving it right along until President Trump happened. Mm-hmm. And we had a conversation with the Obama administration and said, Senator Lara, we're going to do what you want. Do you want to move this forward or do you want to withhold it? Because in federal policy, any resource that you're giving, particularly when it comes to healthcare, you have to identify the individual, where they live, who are their names, address, everything. And it was on that plane ride where I was devastated because I said, no, I'm not going to move the waiver forward and put people at risk of being deported or identified for trying to access care. And I was so pissed off on that plane ride. And then when I decided that the only way we were going to move on healthcare is if we create a single payer system. Mm-hmm. And I landed the next day. I was in Sacramento. I introduced the bill. And, you know, I'm just the new face of single payer. I really stand on the shoulders of so many people that have come before me. Senator Sheila Kuehl, now supervisor, Senator Mark Leno in San Francisco, and countless of advocates that have been working 30, 40 years to make sure that we got to this space. And so, you know, I might be the latest face, but I'm not going to be the last. And so, if I was responsible for sparking that conversation, I'm proud of that. But at the end of the day, I want to make sure that we continue to move forward. And I'll tell you, the groundswell support that we've gotten from just every Californian out there keeps us motivated and keeps the legislature motivated to continue to figure out how we get this done. And if California gets this done, there's no doubt in my mind that it's going to get done throughout the rest of the country, just like in Canada. In Canada in the 50s, it started one small province, Saskatchewan province, started the universal health care. Mm-hmm. And it started because a young child there was denied care because he didn't have insurance. And that young child became the prime minister of Saskatchewan province. And
sounds like the American dream.
Absolutely.
In Canada.
Yeah. The Canadian dream, you know, right? It exists. And so, you know, this is why these issues are so important. And keeping people engaged on what a single payer system looks like, and or a health for all, Medi-Cal for all. You know, it's interesting. A lot of people don't understand what single payer means. And a gentleman came up to me and said, I'm single. Does that mean I have to pay more? I'm like, no. This is why, you know, we have to, you know, we say Medi-Cal for all, healthcare for all, because people that kind of generates like an emotion, right? Yes, healthcare is a right, and it should be a right for everybody, especially, again, in the richest country in the world.
Senator Ricardo Lara, thank you so much for coming on Stonewall Spotlight. Hope to have you on again.
Thank you. I look forward to it. It was great.
I realized one of the most impactful ways to make change is to be involved in policy and legislature. Those who are involved in policy are writing the policy in their best interest. I quickly realized that a critical way to protect the interests most important to me is to be the one involved in writing it and reviewing it and supporting it and opposing it. I am Alana, and I am Stonewall.
Is a county-wide LGBT organization looking for members and volunteers. Are you wondering how to get involved and make a difference in the resistance? Join the Stonewall Democratic Club today by visiting stonewalldems.org. We want you.
When most people hear the phrase, the March on Washington, nonviolent resistance, they think of Martin Luther King Jr., who refused to give up their seat and move to the back of the bus. Thoughts likely turn to Rosa Parks. King and Parks have been rightfully lauded for their inspiring, courageous acts. However, just outside the oft-told narrative of the civil rights milestones is the overlooked life and contributions of Bayard Rustin. It was Bayard Rustin who convinced King to adopt the strategy of nonviolence resistance during the 1956 Montgomery bus boycott. Rustin refused to give up his seat on a bus and was arrested and beaten for his troubles in 1942, 7 years before Parks. And most astonishing of all, it was Rustin who achieved a longtime objective by organizing the March on Washington. By the time he died in 1987, Rustin had spent his entire adult life at the forefront of social rights movements for civil rights, union rights, and gay rights. According to the New York Times, Mr. Rustin's effectiveness as an advocate and organizer was enhanced by his striking appearance. Rustin was also an openly black gay man when it was most dared not to speak about homosexuality positively. In an interview published in The Village Voice on June 30th, Mr. Rustin was quoted saying he was a homosexual. Despite facing prejudice from others in the movement, Rustin noted he wasn't hiding who he was. He was not subject to the blackmail that haunted closeted gays pre-Stonewall. In 2013, President Obama posthumously awarded Bayard Rustin the Presidential Medal of Freedom because he fought tirelessly for marginalized communities at home and abroad. As an openly gay African-American, Mr. Rustin stood at the intersection of several of the fights for equal rights. I am here with Lauren Buisson, Public Relations Vice Chair here at Stonewall. She's been an activist since she was a child, but joined Stonewall after the Trump election. Lauren, it's a pleasure to sit down with you today.
The pleasure's all mine.
Yeah, it's February, Black History Month.
Black History Month, and we've got a great opportunity to show an intersection between celebrating Heroes of Black History Month and Heroes of Gay Liberation.
Absolutely. Well, let's dive right into the first question. We've been hearing a lot lately about hidden figures in modern American history. Given Rustin's influence on King, among others, why aren't his contributions more well known?
Well, if you borrow the title from his collected essays, he was really between two crosses. The first being an African-American man in 20th century United States. And the second is being an openly gay man in the 20th century United States. And we know that that's had a lot to do with his lack of visibility because he was he got a lot of pushback from leaders like Adam Clayton Powell and Roy Wilkins. And that, I think, goes to a lot of why he's not better known. Mm-hmm. Also, too, you know, there are a lot of people like Dorothy Haight who aren't really well known in the civil rights movement. But they were there. We tend to think of the big names as being the only names, but we know a movement is not about a single person.
Sure, absolutely. So how did Rustin come to embrace the nonviolence resistance?
Well, Rustin is a really curious and intriguing cat, as they used to say back in the day. He was born 17th of March in 1912, and that means that he lived through some of the most tumultuous times of the 20th century. Now, he was raised in Chester, Pennsylvania, by his maternal grandparents, who were Quakers.
Huh.
Yeah, and if you know anything about the Quaker faith, you know the first one is they are pacifists.
Yeah, I know that whole friendship.
Exactly. Thing. Hello, friend, yeah. Right? And his grandmother was also a member of the NAACP. And so he grew up with people like W.B. Du Bois and James Weldon Johnson as frequent guests in his home. Now, his first protest was actually in high school. He was a member of the football team, and he grew up in Chester, Pennsylvania, and they were traveling to a game, and he was refused service. Now, part of our lore is that these things only happen in the South, right? Well, no, they happen in northern states, too.
Yeah.
And Rustin, being a Quaker boy, did not pitch a fit. He just refused to leave. And he sat there for hours until they physically removed him. And that kind of lit the spark. Now, in 1922, he matriculated to Wilberforce University, which was what they call a historically black college. And you can't underestimate, as they showed in the movie Hidden Figures, for example, the because of segregation in our schools at all levels, the great role that HBCUs played in making sure that an educated body went forward. But he got himself kicked out for organizing a strike. And you see where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
He he was part of many pacifist organizations early on in his life, One of which wasn't particularly pacifist was the Communist Party. But at the heart of it all is the sense that the dignity, the inherent dignity of every single human being. He went to India in 1948 to go and see how the teachings of Gandhi. Gandhi had been assassinated a little bit before he got there, mm-hmm. but the teachings of Gandhi were very much in place.
Yeah, right in line.
And then he brought them back to the United States.
Oh, wow. So that kind of leads me into my next question about when he refused to give up his bus seat in 1942. How did that whole thing come about?
So typical for Bayard Rustin, he was on an interstate bus bound for Los Angeles to give support to the Japanese that were being interned. Specifically, he was headed out here to help guard the property of internees, which is a whole long and sordid story. And he just refused to give up his seat on this bus. It was the custom when you're traveling through southern states that as new people got on, you got sent further and further back. And he just said no. And he was, they pulled over just outside of Nashville. Mm-hmm. He was taken off the bus by Tennessee police, beaten, though he did not resist, and jailed, but never charged.
Wow. Although he was an organizer of the March on Washington, why was he pushed back behind the scenes while others assumed center stage?
So this is really interesting. So we, at least I, tended to think that the March on Washington sprang fully formed in 1963.
Right.
The March on Washington actually started as a dream of A. Philip Randolph, who was the original head of the Association of Sleeping Car Porters, which was the first big national organization of African-American men as a labor union. And Rustin went to work for him. So Randolph wanted to have this in 1941, and Rustin was in charge of organizing it. Now, this got called off because Randolph and FDR made a deal. FDR actually issued an executive order that forbade discrimination in the defense industries. Mm-hmm. And in any federal employment. So this meant that the leverage that they were using for the march got pushed back, and Rustin wasn't happy about it, but there you are. So in 1963, by the time we get here, Rustin has been loaned to take care of this effort. Now, we also forget it was civil rights, but also jobs. Right? Yeah, the end of discrimination in employment, which Rustin always believed was the essential liberating factor. And he was pushed aside because in 1953, he had been arrested and convicted for what they referred to, he was arrested in Pasadena, for what they referred to then as sex perversion.
What?
Well, he was having sex in the back of the car with two men. Oh. And now, mind you, he's already under the attention of the FBI because he had been a former communist. Mm-hmm. And now they've got a felony, I believe it was a felony conviction, on him for this. And so the leaders of the movement felt that this conviction and the fact that it could be used against them would, how to put it, stain the success of the movement. Mm-hmm. And so he was there. His picture wound up on the cover of Life magazine. People knew he was there, but he was not touted for the humongous job that he did. And in fact, President Obama tells the story, well, it's actually kind of lore, that early in the morning, there weren't that many people at the mall. It's like 5:30 a.m. And the press was beginning to ask if this is going to be a failure. And Bayard Rustin took out his papers and looked at him. He says, no, actually, we're right on time. Trouble is that those papers were blank.
Wow.
Yeah. And but by the end of the day, somewhere between 250,000 and 300,000 people came on foot, by bus, in caravans.
Amazing.
And packed that mall.
Fantastic. Well, President Barack Obama said Rustin stood at the intersection of civil rights for equal rights. How is that so?
Well, he always, Rustin, believed in the essential dignity of all human beings. Now, what makes him interesting is, as I mentioned before, he understood that economic success, and not the Marcus Garvey or Louis Farrakhan kind of separatism, but actually getting a job, being paid the same wages as anybody else, that was the upward mobility. And he was very suspicious of identity politics. Okay. He felt that what most working people have in common, and this may sound familiar, is poverty.
Sure.
And that the enemy was poverty and not each other. Mm-hmm. Later, when Stonewall happened, he, you know, was very straightforward, and he gave a speech, and he declared, and I won't use his exact language, I will paraphrase, that gays are the new blacks, that there was a direct correlation between the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement, because this was fundamentally about human rights.
Mm-hmm.
He said the exact same thing during the feminist movement.
Yeah.
You can find essays on all of these topics, and he is linking them all through the essential dignity of the human being.
Yeah, copy paste.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit more than that, because this guy, what would we call him, like an OG, he didn't just get arrested. He did serious time. He led the first Freedom Rides. Now, I was always under the impression that the Freedom Rides sprang out of the march and the SNCC movement and the students mobilizing in the late 60s. But he did one in 1947. He co-organized the first one, and he flouted then the Jim Crow laws. And he was arrested and sentenced to a chain gang in North Carolina for his troubles.
Wow. So what kind of legacy does Rustin leave for activists today?
Well, the first one would be to be wary of concentrating on identity politics, to make and to build coalitions around common interests. Mm-hmm. I think if we've learned anything from the previous election, that has got to be, for the Democratic Party at least, the way forward. That we are all in this together, that all human beings deserve to be treated with dignity. And moreover, we have to respect each other's pain, I think. Mm-hmm. As a Quaker, as a man of... I guess you could call him a man of faith. He believed this. He didn't just travel, you know, in the United States. He went to Africa. He would help in Haiti observe elections to ensure that they were free. And what he's really saying is, by the life that he lived, this is a struggle. This is a long game. You know, you can't expect immediate results, but what you have to do, and we see this, you know, it's like the Freedom Rides don't get your yield the results that you want in 1947. You don't stop.
No.
You keep going. Mm-hmm. You keep going. Sometimes your gains are going to be incremental. Sometimes they will be huge. But you keep going. And the struggle is real, and it's not brief. But it can be done.
Well, thank you so much for shedding some light on such a pivotal figure.
I just got to say, he is overdue for some real celebration. And while he did get the posthumous Medal of Freedom in 2013, he was kind of overshadowed a bit by the other awardees, people like Bill Clinton and Oprah Winfrey.
Okay.
One little fact I will say is that Rustin, you know, who died in 1987, the award was picked up by his long-term partner, and Walter Nagel. And Nagel actually, because we didn't have gay marriage then, obviously, we didn't have domestic partnerships, in order to ensure that Nagel could get benefits, Rustin actually adopted him as his quote-unquote child.
Really?
Yeah, that was a strategy that a lot of people used in order to take care of their loved ones, because mm-hmm. there was no other legal way to do it.
To provide legal protection.
So, exactly. And to ensure that they would get their inheritance. So... what we have now, and it's been going on since 2014, is a campaign to get Bayard Rustin a postage stamp.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've done this before with Harvey Milk, and I think the time is long overdue for Bayard Rustin to get it.
I love that idea.
So what people can do to move this along, because it feels a little stalled to me right now,
mm-hmm.
is they can go to www.thetaskforce.org and click on the page for the Bayard Rustin stamp campaign. And that has a letter that you can print out. It's already drafted. You can print out postcards and get your organizations or your friends to send them forward. And we know that the agency in charge of generating new stamps responds to public outcry. Now, they've got some good endorsements, but numbers matter. So if people will do that, it's www.thetaskforce.org. Bayard Rustin, honoring unsung LGBTQ heroes.
Excellent. I love that idea. I'm all for it.
Me too.
Well, thank you again, Lauren.
And thank you for having me.
I think I first realized I was an activist when I was in high school. I joined a club called Teens Against Domestic Violence, which was just a group of me and my friends. And then in college at UC Santa Cruz, I joined a number of protests and sit-ins, either protesting the chancellor's pay raise or protesting the UC Board of Regents' policies. I remember walking down the street in the middle of the road and shouting, "Get out of the bus and into the streets," and fighting with other young comrades to prevent any further tuition increase. My name is Sam, and I am Stonewall.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in this week to our inaugural episode of Stonewall Spotlight.
First episode. How exciting.
Yes, we're really, really honored to have such amazing guests on the show, Laurent Buisson, Senator Ricardo Lara, and we're looking forward to bringing you much more in the future.
Yeah, we have so many great people already lined up, so it's only going to go up from here.
Fantastic. Well, make sure you tune in on our Facebook page, stonewalldems.org, and tune in next time as we bring you more resistance reports on Stonewall Spotlight.
I'd also like to thank the Stonewall Democratic Club for bringing us together and making this possible. Thank you to everyone on our communications team. Sean Kaloji, our editor-in-chief, Marcus Lovingood, our producer and my co-host, Alex Paris, our script supervisor and writer, Lauren Buisson, our researcher and writer. Alex Paris and Marcus Lovingood edited this episode. I'm Mackenzie Hussman, your host and contributor. Thank you for listening to Stonewall Spotlight.